I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Montgomery County, just outside of Philadelphia, has been hard hit by coronavirus. According to the latest data from the county commissioners, 5,963 people have tested positive for COVID-19 since March 7th, and 529 people have died from the virus. Most of those deaths were people living in nursing homes. But the virus does not discriminate. The vice chair of the county commissioners, Kenneth Lawrence Jr., tested positive recently and is self-isolating. Montgomery County, like the rest of southeastern Pennsylvania, is still under Governor Wolf's stay-at-home orders. It's in the red zone. We asked Dr. Valerie Arkush to be our guest. She's an anesthesiologist, and she's the chair of the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners, to tell us what's being done to slow the spread of coronavirus. And Dr. Arkush, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. It's great to be here with you.
Nice to have you with us. And I want to make sure our listeners can join the conversation. You can do it several different ways. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Are you self-isolating because of potential contact with the vice chair of the county commissioners?
Well, I was self-isolating for a solid week. I was able to be tested and found that I was tested negative. And since that time, I've made one trip to the grocery store with a mask on, but have continued otherwise to be working from home.
Do you know, does he know how he contracted the virus?
He does not. And in fact, he's a great example of why we're working so hard to ask everyone to take personal responsibility in their actions with this virus. He had no symptoms. He was actually working with that wonderful group of African-American physicians that's been bringing testing to underserved communities. Mm-hmm. And he helped facilitate them coming out to Pottstown, which is in the western part of the county. He went out a week ago Saturday to thank them for coming, and they encouraged him to be tested. He didn't need to be tested. He had no symptoms, but they just thought it was the right message for him to send to be tested. And he came up, much to everyone's surprise, he came up positive.
Wow.
So this is the thing that people do need to be aware of. Any of us could be positive and not have any symptoms, but be contagious. So we must be very careful about how we are out in the community.
Well, let me ask you about a public spat that came to light yesterday, a spat with a fellow commissioner, Joe Gale. You criticized him. This was at the presser yesterday for attending an event for veterans at a cemetery in Conshohocken, part of Montgomery County. You criticized him for not wearing a mask, for not keeping distance from the attendees, many of whom it sounds like were veterans. He accused you of mask shaming, of bullying, of hysteria. Does this tell us something about what's happening maybe behind the scenes at the Board of Commissioners?
Well, I don't even know what he meant by those things, to be honest. I was just sharing good public health advice with the community. And let me explain why. Commissioner Gale also had multiple direct contacts with Commissioner Lawrence. And when you are known to have been in direct contact with someone who's positive, you are supposed to quarantine for 14 days. Commissioner Gale has refused to be tested, so he does not know whether or not he is positive. And he went out to a community event that was attended by many individuals within the age group that we know are most vulnerable to serious complications of this virus. He did not have on a mask, he did not have on gloves, and he was personally handing flags to veterans much closer than the 6-foot distance that's recommended. So for someone who potentially is positive, asymptomatic, but potentially positive and contagious, that is not the right thing that we should be doing to show respect to our veterans or, frankly, to any member of our community.
But if you can't convince a member of the commission to do what the public health officials are telling us to do, how do you convince a reluctant, probably frustrated, maybe skeptical public to keep distance, wear a mask, self-isolate if you've been in contact with someone who has been positive for COVID-19?
Well, it is certainly one of the most difficult things that we are facing. And so many of our businesses, particularly our small business owners, are deeply frustrated, and they're worried, understandably so, about the future of their business. And so I completely understand that people are frustrated and angry and really interested in getting their businesses back open. But, you know, here's the thing. This virus needs another human being in order for it to spread. And if a person who's got the virus doesn't interact with other humans, the virus has nowhere to go, and the virus dies with that person. And so we just have to all internalize that idea, because we're going to be living with this virus for the foreseeable future. There's no really good proven treatment at this point, and there's no vaccine. And I believe it's a matter of our community coming together, taking personal responsibility, each and every one of us, for our actions, and showing just the most basic and simple respect to our neighbors. And wear a mask if you're able. You know, there are people with medical conditions who find it very uncomfortable to wear a mask. I know I wore a mask all day, every day in the operating room. It's not the most fun thing. But wear a mask when you're out around other people. It's a sign of respect, and it will help our entire community move forward as quickly as possible.
Let me ask you about Montgomery County, and it has been hard hit. I mean, I should say that all of us here in the southeastern part of Pennsylvania are still under Governor Wolf's red zone. But Montgomery County in particular seems to have had more cases than the surrounding counties. Why is that?
Well, we were among the first counties to be impacted. We got our first two cases on March the 7th, which seems like about 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
And I will tell you that the first numbers of cases that we had were all related to travel outside of the county to other places in the United States and other countries where COVID-19 was known to be very active. So I think we started out with just some bad luck in terms of the number of people who happened to have been traveling and who brought the virus back to our community. We then had a lot of fairly rapid spread within different community areas, just again through kind of bad luck. You know, someone who was at a very big party. There were a couple of things like that. So, you know, the virus got a foothold here early and started spreading very quickly. And then over time, we started to understand the impact in our long-term care facilities in Montgomery County. Montgomery County in the southeast, I don't know about the whole state, but in the southeast, I believe we have the highest number of long-term care facility beds per capita. We have 70 licensed long-term care facilities here. So it's really been a very substantial impact in those settings.
I know some of the surrounding counties have been saying to the governor, look, don't count what's happening in the nursing homes, because that really skews our numbers. Where do you stand on something like that?
I believe every person needs to be counted. I think it's a very slippery slope to suggest that we shouldn't count certain people. The residents in nursing homes are our parents, our grandparents, our brothers and sisters. And some of the residents in nursing homes are there temporarily recovering from a stroke or a heart attack. And so it's not a population that I think should be discounted. I think it's one that needs to be respected and cared for. And so I have felt that these individuals should be counted. Certainly, these individuals go to hospitals. They impact 911 and first responder resources many times when they do that, and they impact the hospital beds and hospital staff when they get to the hospital. The staff that work in these long-term care facilities have been deeply affected by the virus. These are individuals who work so hard every day, who care so deeply for these patients, and have really undergone enormous loss. The long-term care facility staff do very, very kind of intimate caring with their residents. They dress them, they bathe them, they help feed them in many cases. So this is an entire community that's been impacted, and the staff go home every night to their family and their community. So I do believe that we have to count them. What the county has done is, as soon as we realized the significance of the impact in those facilities, we actually started sending two-person teams into the facilities. Well, we've made now over 70 visits to facilities around the county. We've offered advice and guidance on infection control, helped make sure they had enough personal protective equipment, and we are urging them to all test all of their residents and all of their staff, and we are seeing the numbers come down.
And I know for the governor, it's one, in order to get into that yellow zone or maybe even the green zone, but let's talk about the yellow zone, you need less than 50 cases, I guess, new cases of coronavirus per day. I believe yesterday there were 99 new cases. Do I have that correct?
Yes. So for Montgomery County to meet the governor's strict metric, and remember, that was just one piece of a multi-pronged set of guidance or set of metrics that we need to meet. But for our county, that number is in the low 30s. And, we are getting there, particularly as you look at our 7-day average. You know, we are starting to fairly quickly move in the right direction.
And when you see these new cases, are these largely sort of more older, more vulnerable populations, or are you also seeing it among younger people?
Yeah, we actually see it across all age groups, starting with people in their 20s. And I do want to remind listeners that we still are seeing more cases from the community than we are from long-term care facilities. And that when you break it down in 10-year age increments, number one age group is 50 to 59-year-olds. Number two is 60 to 69-year-olds. And number three are the 30 to 39-year-olds. And that's just looking at absolute numbers. So, I think it's been a little bit misunderstood. There's been so much, and understandably so much focus on long-term care facilities that people are missing who's actually testing positive for the virus. And I think it's important that people understand that many, many younger people are testing positive, but they may not have symptoms. And people say to me all the time, you know, we've been self-isolating and doing all these things. Why aren't our numbers coming down more quickly? And I think it's because we have a much higher number of asymptomatic people who are positive and contagious just out and about in our communities, which why it's so important that people follow all these social distancing guidelines whenever they are out in the community.
We're almost up on our break here, but wouldn't it be wonderful to be able to test everybody and then we would know what we're dealing with?
That is my dream. We're not there yet, but that would be my dream.
Well, let's take a very short break. I know we've got a caller that wants to join us, and you can call us as well. Again, talking with Dr. Valerie Arkush, and she's an anesthesiologist. She's also the chair of the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners, just outside of Philadelphia, talking about efforts by the county to address the problem and to contain the problem of coronavirus, of COVID-19. She's going to stay with us for another 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes or so. You can join us, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. And then in about halfway through the hour, we'll be talking about contact tracing and how that works. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, and if just joining us, I'm talking to Dr. Valerie Arkush, and she is head of the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners. We've been talking about efforts by the commissioners and by the county to address the spread and contain the spread of coronavirus. Let me get Carl from Elkins Park to join our conversation. And Carl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Val. I have a question about how to get people who are unaware of their social distancing to actually back up. I have been in a little bodega store where a guy scratching off lottery tickets just was not paying attention to anything other than his lottery tickets, and he was blocking the aisle and taking up all the space. What 5 or 6 word phrase could I use or people use to get people to either back up or at least give that 6-foot social distance that we need?
Carl, it's a good question. Dr. Arkush, what do you think? What do you say?
Carl, that is a good question, and I wish I knew what those magical five or six words are. But I think that what I've been doing, just in my own experiences in stores, is number one, I'm practicing patience. I'm not the most patient person in the world, but I'm trying to find patience inside of me.
Right.
And I stop, and I just take a couple deep breaths. And often I've noticed that once I just stop moving, the other person does become aware of me, and they will often like sort of look up somewhat startled and realize that, you know, maybe they need to move so that I can safely pass them. So I think that's the first place to start. It's just, you know, give it a minute, or maybe not a minute, but at least a couple breaths. And then just try a very simple, you know, excuse me, please, I'd like to safely pass you. And, you know, almost to put it on you rather than on them, and just imply that you're asking to help keep them safe. I think there's a lot of defensiveness right now out in the community. This issue around masks has become a political statement, which really deeply saddens me. Masks, to me, are a sign of respect for the health of every person in our community, and they shouldn't be viewed as a political statement. So just doing that little act of kindness, you know, could you just move slightly so I can pass you safely? That's a good strategy to try, I think.
Yeah, Carl, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Just a couple of more questions for you. And obviously, we're talking about this public health crisis, but let me ask you about its impact on the coffers, you know, the tax revenue, frankly, coming into the county and the kind of money that you need to keep the roads open and do all the kinds of county services that are required.
Yeah. Well, our budget will definitely take a hit. One thing that we are a little more fortunate with and a little bit different than Philadelphia is that at the county level, our budget does not depend on sales tax. Huh. Our budget is dependent upon a lot of federal and state grant funding, property taxes, and also a number of fees for various things, filing documents, you know, things like that. And so I think that we will overall be less impacted than Philadelphia, which does have a significant portion of revenue that comes from sales tax. I think they'll be impacted in the immediate moment. I think we're going to see a greater impact over time, depending on how we come out of this and what the impact is on property values, business growth, real estate transactions. All of those things are areas where our county gets revenue. So we're planning on a hit for sure, and we're keeping very close track on what everything has been costing us. Thankfully, thanks to some strong work from our federal delegation, our state has received a decent amount of funding from the CARES Act, and our county specifically, as has Philadelphia, received money directly from the CARES Act. And so that is being put to good use to help fund many, if at this point, all of the initiatives that we're taking to combat the virus.
Let me ask you a question as a physician. Now, you're not the physician for the president of the United States, but he said yesterday that he has been taking hydroxychloroquine as I understand it, he was saying as a kind of preventative for coronavirus. The FDA says there are serious side effects. There's no evidence that it works as a kind of preventative, but as an example of leadership, but also when a president does something, follow people that follow him or could be people that would want to do exactly what he's doing. And as a physician, I'm just curious about your response.
Well, I think particularly in a moment like this, where we're battling a virus that was previously unknown until this past January, it's human nature to want to find a treatment or a cure, particularly when the impact is so devastating like this one is. And so doctors and scientists will often throw a lot of things out and try many, many different things on patients because there may be a you know, valid scientific reason to try it in the patient, but then we have to follow the results. And with hydroxychloroquine in particular, it is not being recommended. The FDA has actually said there's no evidence that it is a valid treatment for this disease, We also have no evidence that it has value as a preventive treatment for this disease. And with this drug in particular, it can cause very serious side effects, particularly heart arrhythmias. And so I would caution anyone to, really pay attention to what the Food and Drug Administration and other very valid agencies that are doing solid research are saying, and follow the evidence-based guidelines if you are attempting to try any new treatment.
Let me just toss a couple of more things at you. Emily wonders whether summer camps in Montgomery County will be open. Can you speak to that?
Well, I hope so. So under Governor Wolf's plan, once we get to the yellow phase, summer camps will be allowed to open. Summer camps are being treated in the governor's plan like childcare, because in the summertime, for those of us that are parents, they certainly serve that function. And so it would be okay for summer camps to open, so that hopefully parents would be able to get back to work if their businesses had started back up.
And one just quick question, then we're going to have to say goodbye. And this is actually something we're going to be covering in the next week or so. But JD from Cheltenham asks about poll workers and voter safety with the upcoming election. And again, something we're going to address in about a week and a half. But your quick thoughts, if you don't mind.
Yes. So I would certainly encourage everybody to vote by mail. You can still apply for a vote by mail ballot. And particularly if you have any health conditions or are older, I would strongly encourage that. We've consolidated our polls in Montgomery County, as has Philly, so everyone should check where their new polling place is. Many people will have new polling places. And we are supplying our poll workers with masks and face shields and gloves and lots of sanitizer and cleaning supplies for the poll. And we're just asking everyone who does choose to vote in person to please wear a mask and please observe all social distancing guidelines that will be clearly delineated at the poll. And just let's make this as safe as possible for everybody in our community.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today in Radio Times. Valerie Arkush, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marty. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. You too. Thank you very much. And she's chair of the Montgomery County Board of Commissioners. Testifying last week, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, warned states and cities that are opening up for business that without having the ability to manage and contain new cases, they could see spikes of COVID-19 turning into outbreaks. Efforts to find a vaccine are being fast-tracked. And in the meantime, we have several tools to slow the spread of the virus. We've been talking about some of that: masks, social distancing, testing, and contact tracing. This involves specially trained trackers to identify people who have been in contact with someone who has tested positive for coronavirus and to help them self-isolate. It's believed that for contact tracing to be effective, we'll need between 15 to 30 trackers per 100,000 people in the United States, and we're not there yet. Joining us is Emily Gurley. She's an infectious diseases epidemiologist and associate scientist at Johns Hopkins University, and she leads a free online class to train coronavirus tracers. Emily Gurley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can be part of our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, if you have any kinds of questions or even comments about contact tracing. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up your phone and call us at 1-888-477-9499. How long has contact tracing been around as a public health tool?
Well, it's been around about as long as we've had public health as a concept, as a formal concept. So, many, many decades, maybe 100 years or so. There's nothing new about contact tracing.
But we're talking about it because it is one of the tools, I guess, until we get to this possibility of a vaccine addressing this virus. We have a handful of things that we can do, contact tracing being one of them. How has it been worked? How has it been used in the past?
So in the way contact tracing works is that you find people who have the disease that you're interested in stopping, find the people who've been exposed and could potentially become infectious themselves. And you ask those people who've been exposed to change their behaviors so that they don't have contact with anyone else. And so what you're trying to do is get people to change their behaviors to stop the spread. So you want to change the behavior of the person who already has the disease and everyone they've had contact with. That's how it's always worked, and that's how it works for this coronavirus as well.
Did it work for things like, I'm thinking about Ebola or smallpox or SARS or MERS, other outbreaks that we've had in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. It's used every day. You know, before this pandemic, the health departments across the country used contact tracing for tuberculosis, HIV, sexually transmitted diseases. It was a key component of the measures used in West Africa to stop the recent large Ebola outbreak there. Wow. So it's used all the time for many diseases, and particularly for those that we don't have other good measures. Right? This is the best we have.
Absolutely. Certainly for now. Let me ask you about the kind of training then, and perhaps even the kind of person who has the kinds of qualities that can be helpful, because you're talking about asking someone to change their behavior. That's not something people willingly or necessarily want to do. So what are the kinds of skills that a contact tracer needs?
So contact tracers, I think, play multiple roles. So they are detectives in a certain sense, but they're also social workers and therapists. They're contacting someone during what could be, you know, to deliver some news that can be scary, concerning. When you ask people to cut off contact with everyone else to prevent the spread of the infection, you know, as you mentioned, some people may need some motivation to really understand why it's important. But I think even for people who understand the importance of doing that and want to do that, it's just not easy to do. You need a plan to get food. You need a plan to get medicines. Imagine that you're a parent and you can't have contact with your children.
Right.
So I think there is a part of, you know, making sure people understand why, but there's a whole nother part of the job that's about helping people to put together a reasonable plan to do it. So I think contact tracers need to, it's a very important job, but it can be a difficult job, because you're engaging with people during a difficult time in their lives. Trying to support them. Again, important work, but it can be taxing. So the best contact tracers are people who are up for that. who really understand the importance of the work, but are also good at building rapport with people. Ultimately, people need to feel, supported.
Well, let me pick up on that. And I'm interested in the kind of social work therapy part of it and building that rapport. And I guess building a trusting relationship, because as I understand it, it's not that you just deliver the bad news and then you go away. You're really there as a support person as they live through and deal with their self-isolating.
That's correct. So contact tracers will be in touch at regular intervals, usually every day, in one way or another, to check in, to see how you're feeling, to see if you need resources. And that's for cases and contacts. So, when we talk about contact tracing, it's the whole package. And so it is about building a relationship with those individuals. But I do think that, it's not just the responsibility of the contact tracer to build that rapport and trust. That would be like saying, it's the person who delivers the vaccines to build, trust in the community about the vaccine program. Well, that's a lot to put on their shoulders. It's really the responsibility of all of us, our elected officials, public health officials, community, religious leaders, to talk to people about what contact tracing is. Make sure there's a place to talk about contact tracing, answer everyone's questions, make sure that there's no misinformation out there about what contact tracing is and that people know why it's being done and how it can help them. So I think it's all of our responsibility to build that broader community trust and respect for this public health program.
You know, I'm thinking of someone, if a contact, let's say I tested positive for COVID-19, and then a contact tracer would ask me, well, who have you been in contact with in the last 14 days? And I think because so many of us are self-isolating, I can actually probably answer that question. But I would think for some people, they may not want to reveal everything about their private life. How do you deal with that?
Sure. Well, I mean, and just a caveat, so it wouldn't be the past 14 days. So the first questions that they would ask you would be to try to define when you were infectious.
Right.
So patients are infectious while they are sick, and just the 2 days before. So typically they wouldn't be asking about the past 14 days. That would mean that they found the case quite late.
Right.
You know, ideally, they're only asking about the last few days or maybe the last week. So there are issues about, you know, even just recalling that. And, you know, they have some tips that they can help people walk through to try to remember things. And it's true, no one really enjoys an intrusion into their personal lives. But it's not for fun. It's for an important purpose. And the purpose is to make sure that people know they've been exposed because, again, as we know about this virus, you can be infectious without ever having symptoms, or you can be infectious before you develop symptoms, up to 2 days before. And no one would want to unknowingly infect someone they love. And so it's a way to respect those people who have been exposed and their loved ones, and try to give them the help that they need to keep from transmitting to others.
Well,
and I think,
you know what? Hold on, only just because we have to take a very short break, Emily Gurley. We're going to be right back, and we are talking about contact tracing, something that Emily Gurley teaches in a free online class. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and we're talking about how contact tracing can be deployed to slow the rate of COVID-19 infections. And our guest is Johns Hopkins research scientist Emily Gurley, and she's leading a free online class to train tracers. We're talking about how contact tracing works, and we'll be talking about some of the challenges and even some of the concerns as some of these contact tracers are trained and begin to ask questions. And again, you can join us, Radio Time. At WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Emily, I had to jump in and interrupt you right before the break, but you were talking about the critical issue of timing, you know, because of how this disease can be asymptomatic for a certain period of time, and the importance of trying to get in there quickly before someone is spreading it unwillingly or unknowingly.
Right. And I you mentioned also the privacy concerns that some folks yep. have about sharing where they've been or who they've been with. But I wanted to also just make the point that if you are sharing your contacts and telling the contact tracer who you may have exposed, they're going to contact those people and let them know that they have been exposed, again, so that they don't unknowingly infect someone else. But they'll never tell that person who the case patient is. They'll never tell them that it was you they had contact with. So I think that's important for people to understand. So you can share your contacts freely with a contact tracer, your contacts will never know that you're the person who they may have been infected by. And I think that's important for people to know as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, the certain level of privacy. I mentioned in my introduction that you need between 15 and 30 people per 100,000 to be effective, to be able to really deploy enough people to do this contact tracing. How close are we to that?
In most places, I think not close at all, although they're getting there. I mean, I would just note that this is sort of a ballpark estimate of where to start. There are many caveats. Theoretically, it's easy to understand that you need enough people to be able to identify all the cases quickly and all their contacts very quickly so that your program is effective. But putting numbers to that can be a bit tricky, and it's dynamic because the number of new cases you have every day is changing. So the numbers that are out there now per population, I think it's a good starting point. It's a good target for folks to start with. And then they can track their own epidemics and see where they are and evaluate their contact tracing programs to see if they're really being effective as they need to be or if they need to ramp up further to really contain the spread.
And if we're talking about contact, we're not talking about someone knocking on your door, but phone contact, correct?
Yes, usually that's how it happens. And other contact tracing programs, they do find people in the community. They may do some of that for COVID-19 as well, particularly if they're not able to reach people by phone. And that's, again, just because they want to make sure that people have the information that they need to protect themselves. You know, even if you've lost your phone or your number has changed or, you know, maybe you had contact with someone, but they don't know your phone number. So if it's, you know, it's their job to try to find folks, again, just to let them know about their own health. So sometimes they could do that. Yeah.
We've got a lot of questions. Just one more follow-up. You've mentioned the word community several times, the importance of community buy-in for things like contact tracing.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think buy-in, which includes understanding.
Right.
Why it's being done, understanding what is being done. I think people have some misconceptions about, what the process looks like and why. Communities need to understand, and they need that channel of communication back to programs to help, make them as efficient as they can be.
Here's a question from Nick. He just wonders, how can I apply for contact tracing jobs in the Philadelphia area? Do you know the answer to that?
Well, I've been really impressed by all the people who want to help, help their communities and apply for these jobs. I think you're going to have to contact your local health department about their plans to hire and train new folks. I'm afraid I don't have any information about that.
To be specific, but yeah, contact the health department. Always a good idea. Here's Lee from Philadelphia who asks, could the guests explain how asymptomatic people are contagious? Aren't they making antibodies? Can you address that?
Mm-hmm. So everyone who is infected with SARS coronavirus 2 will make some antibodies. So that's independent of whether or not you develop signs or symptoms. So you're infectious if you are still shedding some virus. So it takes time for the body's immune response and for the development of antibodies to reach a certain level where it can control infection and stop replication of the virus in the respiratory tract. And that takes time for people with symptoms and without symptoms. So whether you have symptoms or not, you're still shedding the virus for a certain amount of time until you're your immune system can get the replication under control.
And we've done so many interviews, as you can imagine, last couple of months about coronavirus, but it seems like the asymptomatic carriers, that is just a kind of a wild card in this whole pandemic.
Yeah, that's a feature of this virus that makes it particularly difficult to control. Yeah. And also the pre-symptomatic transmission. So people are infectious before they're sick. Those are two things that in any disease or any infection, if people are able to transmit without knowing they're sick, that makes it much, much harder to control.
We've been talking about contact tracing, but obviously that depends on testing. And the latest numbers I heard is something like 4% of the population has been tested. I'm not sure what should be, you know, the goal for that. But nonetheless, without adequate testing, can you really do contact tracing the way you want to do it?
Sorry, could you repeat that question? You broke up just a bit.
Apologies. Oh, no. That's okay. We're all working from home and it all makes it potentially very complicated. No, I was interested in the connection between testing and contact tracing, that contact tracing really relies on testing, but we are still at something like 2 or 4% of the population that's been testing. So we're in a bit flying blind here.
I would say, two-part answer, so a yes and a no. So when we think about testing and how much testing we need, you know, there are certain groups of individuals that need to be screened for asymptomatic, infections. You know, obviously people in healthcare settings, long-term care facilities, there are people for the protection of others who need to be screened very regularly. Right. Ideally, you'd want to screen maybe even people who've been exposed. But, you know, I think when we think about testing and how well we're doing, I think a good metric is what proportion of people with symptoms that are compatible with COVID-19 are actually getting a test? Personally, I would focus on that as well, rather than thinking about how many tests per population, because really what you want to do is find people, finding people who have asymptomatic transmission or asymptomatic infections may be more difficult, but think about the people who actually have disease. What proportion of those are we able to test? I think in many places it's still on the lower end. So that's the yes. This does depend on testing. And the more people you can test, the more effective your program is going to be. On the no side of this two-part answer, I would just say that contact tracing is not an all or nothing. Right. It will be more or less effective depending on how fast it is, how many cases you're finding, all of the things that we've already mentioned. But if you're finding any cases and you are isolating them and you're finding some of their contacts and you're getting them to quarantine, you're going to have an impact. And because the disease or the infection can double so quickly, turns the number of cases, even stopping, a proportion of all infections has a major impact on the total number of cases that you're eventually going to see. It's not a zero-sum game.
Yep, yeah. I hear you. Cindy asks, should we all be keeping a daily calendar about our outside activities since it's hard to remember sometimes things that happen a week or so later? What do you think?
My life is so highly scheduled these days.
I know what you mean.
I think that's a great idea. What a huge help for public health, and what a huge help, to the people you're around to be able to quickly let them know if they've been exposed. I think it's a great idea.
What about apps? I mean, the idea of, and I think Google and some others are coming up with or have come up with a way of sort of tracking people's behavior. That, of course, does raise some privacy issues. But is that something that we should incorporate as part of this public health effort?
Well, the scale and the speed of contact tracing for COVID-19 is beyond what we've ever thought of doing for other infectious diseases we use contact tracing for here. So it's really a daunting task that we're being faced with. So in that kind of scenario, with this kind of task in front of us, we should look for all solutions that are going to help us do that job better and more efficiently. I think there's a lot of misinformation about what these apps do. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they're currently being used in the U.S. And just to be clear, the apps themselves are things that that the individual would have to download themselves. So this isn't something mandated. It's something that people could use if they wanted to.
The kind of buy-in that comes with downloading something like that. I'm watching the clock
exactly.
here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Margaret wants to know, does contact tracing work different for kids?
Well, it's a bit different. You have to talk to the parents, right?
Right.
So you'll be talking to the guardians. If it's a child who's older, I mean, they also may need to talk to that child to see who they've had contact with. Sometimes, you know, parents don't know everything a 17-year-old's up to all day.
No, they don't.
And so you may need to talk to the child as well. But
is
the,
there a...
Go ahead. But the concept is the same.
I hear you. Is there a country that you think has used or is using contact tracing that has been effective, that's a model that we could look at?
All countries are using contact tracing to more or less, some have done a really good job with contact tracing. New Zealand is a great example where they've actually stopped transmission altogether. And so therefore can go about their lives again, which sounds fantastic. You've got to be quick, and you've got to have the people in place to find cases and contacts quickly. There's no special secret. That's it. So first we've got to start ramping up the programs, and then we have to monitor and make sure that we're doing everything fast enough to have the impact that we want to see here. And the impact we're after is just keeping transmission levels stable while we open up economies and give the virus more opportunities, right? So we have to be really on our game.
Well, we're almost out of time here. We know with the warm weather, people are going outside over the weekend. There were crowded boardwalks and bars and restaurants, and people not wearing masks, sitting close together. As a epidemiologist, when you look at something like that, what is your reaction?
Worry. Because the virus hasn't gone away. If we don't wear masks and take precautions to protect ourselves and each other, we're just going to see a resurgence in cases, which I fear would lead us back to where we just came from. And that's not what any of us want to see. So let's do ourselves a favor and try to take the advice seriously to wear a mask when you're around other people, and to try to keep that safe distance as much as you're able.
Well, Emily Gurley, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
You're very welcome. And she's an infectious disease epidemiologist, also associate scientist at Johns Hopkins University. And she is the leader of a free online class to train coronavirus tracers. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. We've got probably hundreds, probably thousands of podcasts that you can listen to at this point in time. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.